It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the FDA is reevaluating marijuana and could change its status as one of the most restricted drugs in the country. We'll find out what goes into that decision.
First, from Jackie Mason, Chris Farley, and the Zucker brothers to everyone's fake newspaper, The Onion, Wisconsin has a rich history of comedic talent.
With top-rated comedy clubs in Madison and Milwaukee, the past few years have seen an influx of A-list national comedians, including Wisconsin as a tour stop.
Today, we're joined by two emerging Wisconsin comedians. John Egan is a stand-up comic from Green Bay. John, welcome to the studio.
Hello.
And Stacy Kulo is with us. She is the winner of this year's Madison's Funniest Comic Contest. Stacy, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, Stacy, let's start with you. How did you get into doing stand-up comedy?
I've been in an improv group, Atlas Improv, which is right here in Madison, since 2008, which is how I met my boyfriend, and he was already doing stand-up comedy, and he encouraged me to try it also.
And John, your origin story.
Oh, I actually started doing it back in high school. There was kind of an improv type thing as well. And then I've been doing that ever since, and then stand up here and there, and then got serious about it.
Before we get into the Wisconsin comedy scene, I'm always amazed that people get up and do stand up. It seems like one of the loneliest, scariest things you could do. How do you psych yourself up, or is this just my personal phobia here, Stacy?
I don't know. I've never really been that scared to do it. I haven't had that much stage fright. I did like plays and stuff in high school and grade school. So
I know, but stand up, you're alone and you're seeing an audience reaction, and there's a tradition of negative response in stand up comedy. It seems different.
Right. I think, though, because you have like a set of prepared material that you know has worked before. And that's one thing that's great about Madison is there's different open mics. You can like hone your skills before you actually perform it in front of a real audience.
Mm-hmm. And John, is Wisconsin a good place to be a stand-up comic? Because we're all too polite to tell you if something isn't funny. We'll still just laugh along to be nice.
No, that's not true. There's plenty of you who do not like to laugh. No, it's a good place. I mean, any state than another. I mean, you'd probably be surprised that you have places to go to than most people. Because when I grew up, we were just talking about before the show that when we were growing up, we had no idea that you could become a stand-up comedian in Wisconsin and live in Wisconsin.
Well, let's talk about where you can go and do or see stand-up comedy in Wisconsin. Stacy, I don't know about that many comedy clubs around the state, but there are more than I knew about. What's the scene like?
Yeah, well, there's right here in Madison, there's the Comedy Club on State, which is great. I think people there do like to laugh because it's smart people, college town, but it's also big drinking culture. So a mix of those two things makes for a good audience. But there's also Comedy Cafe in Milwaukee. There's the Skyline Comedy Club in Appleton. Those are the ones I've been to. Mm-hmm.
And then up in Green Bay, where you're based, John, what's the scene like up there?
We had an improv club called Comedy City up there. And then actually recently we renamed it into a bar. And then we started doing stand-up every Thursday. So that kind of like reinvigorated myself into it. So you could do it every week instead of no scene. Up until that point, there wasn't anything north of Appleton.
And do people, I do music around town in the state sometimes. It's hard to get people to show up. Maybe it's just us. Do a lot of people come out to see the comedy in these towns?
It really depends. You can't predict it. Mm. It's, you know, one week you'll have 50 people. The other week you'll cancel.
It doesn't really.
Yeah. Even between the shows for like 7:30 and 9:30, 7:30 sold out, 9:30 canceled. We're done. We're go home. It's weird. You can't predict it.
What's the smallest crowd you've played, Stacy?
Maybe like 10 people.
10? Okay. Is it harder to do it when there's not a big group of people out there to get that wall of laughter?
Yes.
I guess it depends on the situation, too, where, I mean, if you feel comfortable enough to talk to them and if you can kind of see them, it's fine. Where I did a show for 4 people, and other people before me did a lot of anti-religious material. So I was like, I will talk to them because they're not getting a response. And it was a pastor and his family. He's not going to respond to that. And then when you start talking to him, then you can kind of joke around and figure out the material. And then they can enjoy themselves because they don't feel attacked.
Now, I've seen movies about comedians in L.A., and it's cutthroat, but still there's a camaraderie. You two aren't at each other's throats in here. Is there a camaraderie, John, among Wisconsin comedians?
I would say so. Yeah, I mean, we help each other out. I mean, I think Stacy gave my name for one of these programs. I gave her name when Green Bay was looking for opener. So you kind of help each other out because why would you compete? I mean, what's the point of hating each other? Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't in a small community.
And you've both, I think, opened for some touring national comics who come through the state. Stacy, how hard is it to get those opening gigs?
I think once that you've kind of established yourself and people know that you have good jokes, you become like a go-to for someone that could open for someone like that. It kind of depends. Like, if it's a big theater, you kind of need to have a reputation that someone can just find you and ask you. But just in the local scene, I don't know, you can kind of just ask. No one's taken it yet. You can open for someone like that.
Mm-hmm. John, have you gotten any good opening gigs for people coming through town?
Yeah, but it's about the same thing. Yeah. It's kind of about luck, timing, and then having the owner like you, or, you know, having good sets, basically. It's a combination of a lot of things.
Who do you go to for feedback? I know there's a lot of honing and crafting for doing stand-up. How do you get that feedback? Or is it just from what the audience reacts to and doesn't react to? How about John first?
I would say so. A lot of it is feedback. But other times, if a headliner talks to me, or like the main comic talks to me about something they saw, I'll take that in consideration. Or if I talk to them in between shows about other things, that usually brings up material. So it's kind of like a more conversational type thing.
And Stacey, how do you hone the craft?
Yeah, I'd say sometimes it's other comedians. Like, one of my best jokes, a local comedian gave me a suggestion for it. And my boyfriend and I obviously both do it, so we are kind of each other's biggest helpers in that regard. But yeah, just performing in front of an audience, I think, is one of the best ways to get your material crafted. I've noticed that jokes that work here won't work the same in Appleton. Like, it's almost different audiences up there. So you kind of have to test out material in different places to see what works and what doesn't.
And when you talk to people from the national scene, do they have that same sense what works wherever they came from might not work when they play in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I definitely think so. People talk about having, like, material that works in, like, L.A. and New York, but not necessarily working in the Midwest, or vice versa.
Do you have to fly, you know, play it by ear? And even though you've got your plan, what you were planning to bring to the audience, do you have to change it on the fly?
I don't do it a lot. Just I don't know, because it's hard to do that, just to switch over. I mean, you can do it, but usually I have my set, and if it doesn't work out, I'll switch a little bit, or if I need more time, I'll throw a couple more things in. But usually I like to stick to it to know if I want to use it or not.
Do we have a lot of good comics here in Wisconsin, Stacey?
Yeah, I think we definitely do. The contest that I won in February, the top 10, top 20 was just, like, saturated with talent. It was going to be very hard to win. And there's a few headliners, national headliners, that have come out of here also.
And John, up in Green Bay, Fox Cities area, a lot of good people up there?
Yeah, it's definitely growing. I mean, it was a lot smaller, but now, yeah, we're having the same, like, a group of, I would say, 7 or 8 of us that are starting to do the same clubs around Wisconsin, starting to get to know people. And it's nice to have that camaraderie with the people that are near you.
You know, I've seen a lot of stand-up on TV. I've only been out to see stand-up in person really a couple of times in my life. I guess it's not on my radar. I want to hear both of you make the case for people to get out and check out some stand-up. Stacey?
I guess before I started doing it, I didn't really know much about it. Like, I didn't really grow up watching it or knowing much about it. I'm still learning a lot about all these famous headliners from the 80s and everything. But yeah, it's a great night out. Like, people always come up to me and say it was their first time and that they had a really good time. They didn't know what to expect. So check out the Comedy Club on State.
And John, make your pitch for people to come out and see some comedy.
I don't know. Just go. Everyone likes to laugh. That's the whole thing. Every time you talk to a coworker or somebody else, they'll say, well, I need to get out there. Okay, well, you have to do it. Like, you have to take the initiative and Google just your city and comedy club and find something and just show up. Because people like laughing. That's what.
And whether they have influenced you or not, do you have a favorite stand-up to watch in person or recorded?
Oh, boy. I guess I have to go back to my first CD I ever listened to was Dennis Leary when I was 6. Mm. Probably shouldn't have listened to it, but talked about drinking beer and eating red meat and smoking. I'm like, I'm 6, guys.
Maybe he has influenced your comedy. Maybe he's influenced your life, though.
Oh, yeah. I'm a very angry person, so I'm the same way. So
Stacey, a favorite?
I have so many favorites. One of my favorites is actually from Wisconsin, Pete Lee. He's from Janesville, but he's in New York now, doing great.
Okay. And, of course, before you leave us, can you tell us what is the deal with airline food? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't think that you get it anymore. I wish.
That's true. It's non-existence. That's killed. It's a real staple of old-school stand-up comedy
humor.
That's
the deal with cookies.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. I'll try to check out your shows sometime in Madison. John, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
And Stacey, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Stacey Kulo and John Egan. They're both stand-up comedians here in Wisconsin. The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing medical evidence on the safety and effectiveness of marijuana at the request of the Drug Enforcement Agency. The review process could lead to a reclassification of the drug.
Ryan Von Drey is with us to talk about the news. He's an associate professor of behavioral pharmacology research at Johns Hopkins University. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks.
Well, the FDA has reviewed marijuana twice in the recent past. So why again? Why now?
Well, I think that there's a lot of increasing political pressure to figure out the discrepancy between state and federal law regarding marijuana.
So they'll be looking at state and federal law in terms of what? What kind of things would influence the way they thought about it?
Well, in all honesty, I don't know that there's all that much different knowledge now regarding medical benefits of marijuana than the last time they reviewed this. But what you have is the same issue, where you have a lot of anecdotal evidence and people saying that it has medical benefit, but not much scientific support. And a lot of the lack of scientific support comes from the fact that it's incredibly difficult to conduct research with a Schedule I compound. So currently you have medical use ongoing in half of the states in the U.S., but, you know, they're doing that without collecting much data on efficacy. You really need to kind of come to some better way of being able to gather the information on whether or not there really is true medical benefit, and then move forward with that in terms of medical use based on what you find. So if you reschedule the drug and you move it down to Schedule II, it makes it much easier to access for researchers, much easier to conduct clinical trials and look at whether or not it has benefits for things like MS and side effects from cancer therapy.
And you mentioned that marijuana is currently a Schedule I drug. What does that mean?
Yeah, so Schedule I drug is a designation for drugs that have high abuse potential but zero medical benefit.
Such as?
So examples of that would be LSD, heroin, psilocybin or psilocybin-containing mushrooms. A lot of hallucinogens are placed in that category. And there's people that argue that those compounds have medical benefit as well. So, you know, a lot of it is kind of up to debate.
It's interesting because the other drugs that you named, things like cocaine and LSD, heroin.
Well, actually, cocaine is Schedule II.
Cocaine is Schedule II. Okay, I thought that was in Schedule I. Well, a lot of the other drugs that you did name, you know, it seems as though, at least at first blush, that marijuana would not be as dangerous. So how did marijuana end up in that cohort?
There's a long history of political controversy surrounding marijuana, and this dates back literally thousands of years. What ended up happening is back in the early part of the 20th century, there was a political movement to make marijuana illegal, and that succeeded in the Tax Act of 1937. The middle of the century, 1969, the Tax Act was ruled unconstitutional, and shortly thereafter, what we currently have as the Controlled Substances Act was passed. And so that's the current legislation that formally makes marijuana an illegal drug.
And so what happens now? It's being reconsidered by the FDA. What are the things that need to change, at least in the review process, and how marijuana is evaluated that would move it to, say, a Schedule II?
Yeah, so the review that the FDA is going to do is kind of a standard review process that they do for any number of drugs. It's called an eight-factor analysis. And what that does is they look at relative potential for abuse. They look at the pharmacological effects of the drug, current knowledge about patterns of abuse, what the consequences of those are, the public health consequences of that. And then they also will look at, again, you know, medical benefit purported or established. And then they basically try to conduct a risk-benefit analysis or assessment of the drug. So the challenge for marijuana right now is, again, demonstrating the medical benefit. So As I mentioned before, a lot of the evidence for medical benefit coming from marijuana are just kind of case reports, uncontrolled studies. There have been a few published controlled studies in the last decade or so, so that may help the cause a little bit. But the method of demonstrating health benefit of marijuana has gone down a very different path from development of new medications.
And how so? How has it gone down a different path?
Yeah, so, I mean, because for one thing, marijuana is not a patentable chemical compound. So typically with drug discovery and medicine, you have a single entity like a pharmaceutical company. They identify a compound, they develop it, they go through rigorous scientific analysis in laboratories and in clinical trials. Under guidance by the FDA, and then they are able to submit an application to have it approved for a very particular use. What's happened with marijuana is that people have used it almost as a folk remedy. You know, someone says that it helps with this, and by and large, people try it, and they'll tell everyone, oh, yeah, it helped me with that. But that's really been the extent of it. The other problem is that with marijuana, there's a lot of hesitancy from the medical community in terms of having a medicine that's smoked. Okay, physicians generally view smoking medicine as a bad thing. And so people are working on alternate ways of administering marijuana that might get around that hurdle.
And we are, at the moment, we're riding a wave where medical marijuana, at least you know, things like research and legalization of medical marijuana, has been legalized in 22 states and marijuana in general in Colorado. Does that have anything to do with the timing of this?
Well, like I said, I think it does. I think it has a lot to do with it. There, like I said at the beginning, there's intense pressure, I think, across the board, both from at the federal level and the state level, for coming to some kind of consensus on how to handle marijuana. Public opinion is obviously shifting in favor of medical marijuana, and more so even towards recreational marijuana use. But the medical marijuana thing is the key point here, where you have millions of people, again, approximately half of the country, being told by their local governments that using marijuana for designated medical purposes and with permission by the state, that that's okay. But then you have the federal government saying that it's not okay and that they could be prosecuted for having marijuana. And you can't do that. And a lot of local politicians, national politicians, and agencies don't really know how to treat it. And so there needs to be some sense of resolution with this contradiction in law.
Ryan, what kinds of drugs and treatments are under investigation right now as it comes to medical marijuana?
So right now, people are looking at marijuana for a handful of medical purposes. The main ones are being control of pain, inflammation, and spasticity. In addition, it has nausea reduction qualities to it. And then there's some more fringe applications that are being investigated as well, such as treatment of PTSD and other psychiatric disorders. Again, the real evidence to support the utilization in a lot of those is lacking, but there's a lot of support for the pain management and the spasticity piece. And that comes from the fact that THC, which is the psychoactive constituent in marijuana, the main active component of it, is actually already FDA approved as a synthetic pill and has been on the market since 1986. So there's certainly support that constituents of the marijuana plant have medical benefit. It's just a question of whether the whole marijuana plant should be treated differently and whether there's added benefit of the marijuana plant versus the available drug that's already out there.
We're talking right now with Ryan Von Dre of Johns Hopkins University about the news that the FDA is reviewing information about marijuana.
And we're taking your calls next. What do you think about this news? Do you think marijuana should be classified as a less dangerous drug than it currently is? Why or why not? What do you think about the potential medical benefits of marijuana or want to ask about them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're continuing our conversation with Ryan Von Dre of Johns Hopkins University about the FDA's review of marijuana.
We're taking your calls now. What do you think about the news that the FDA is taking another look at marijuana, maybe changing its classification? Should marijuana be classified as a less dangerous drug than it currently is? Why or why not? And what do you want to ask about the potential medical benefits of marijuana? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
And we'll go to our phone lines now. Take our first call from Joe calling from Eau Claire. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What do you think?
I definitely would support another look at marijuana and its harmful effects. I think one thing that we haven't talked about already was, I think it's called the LD50, which is the harmful dose that a drug is given or can be like taken and then it like does harm to you or can kill you. And we have drugs, you know, opiates and painkillers that where you take 5 or 6 pills and you can kill yourself. Whereas I think, I'm speaking out of, I guess, personal experience, that if you smoke a lot of weed, you're not going to die. You'll probably fall asleep. However, that's probably not the same for everybody. That should be looked at. And I think that's one thing that we need to do, is that we need to look at the harmful effects of marijuana and actually, like, get that hammered out. And that's one thing that's actually being held back by, you know, the schedule or the Schedule I status that it's under right now. And I mean, comparing them to other drugs that we even find socially acceptable in society, such as alcohol and tobacco, I mean, tobacco kills 500,000 people a year, and we accept that as a drug. However, we don't accept marijuana because of its psychoactive effects. However, I think those should be also taken into account as a positive. I mean, people who use for anxiety, something to handle anxiety, like someone talked about PTSD. I mean, I think there's definitely potential there. And, I mean, we can argue about whether it should be an actual, I guess, recreational drug, but definitely medical marijuana should be looked at again.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your thoughts, Joe. And Joe pointing out that having marijuana as a Schedule I drug is holding back some of the research. And one thing he was getting at there was how to regulate it and get a handle on dosages and how they affect people. What do you think about that, Quagmire?
Well, I can say a couple things in response to his comments. One is that when you're evaluating medical benefit of a drug, it's important to focus on that and not how likely it is to kill you. So that's something to consider for sure. But the example of a cigarette, you don't smoke a pack of cigarettes and instantly die like you overdose with opioids. But I think regulation is a very important piece of this, and is also something that's another important reason why we have to get federal regulation and state regulation on the same page. Currently, in the medical marijuana states, each state has its own set of statutes for overseeing production, packaging, and dispensing of the medical marijuana. But the federal agencies that are responsible for oversight of all other medications and for food and other things like that are left out of it. So the strict requirements for quality control, product and dose consistency, and things like that are currently lacking with the state-run medical marijuana system. So I think that's very important to look at and to consider moving forward.
And how do you expect this reevaluation of marijuana to move forward? How long does such an evaluation take, and how soon might any subsequent changes come?
Well, that unfortunately, that's all going to be subject to the person who's driving the wheels on this reevaluation. As we know, things at the government level can happen quickly or it can drag on for months and months. The FDA, from what I've seen, has not set a timeline on when they're going to finalize their reevaluation. I think that if they receive enough pressure to get it done quickly, they could do that. But if they don't receive it, it could drag on for quite some time.
And if they were to move marijuana to, say, a Schedule II, a less harmful substance, and open the doors for more medical research, would that also naturally bring about legalization, do you think, for recreational uses, or is that a whole different animal?
That's a whole different animal. And it'll really, I think a lot of the whether the movement going that route is going to continue is really going to depend on what happens in Washington and Colorado over the next year or two. You know, they're really the world's petri dishes on this. So far, you know, they've been under a heavy media scrutiny. There have been, you know, case reports of, you know, the case of the guy who ate a potent brownie and jumped off a balcony has been spread across the place. ER visits are reportedly up, and they're analyzing car crash data. But it's going to take a couple years to really fully and carefully evaluate what happens there, and I think that's going to inform whether that continues to spread or not. From the medical perspective, I think that reducing it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, as I said before, will make it much more available for scientific research, for medical research. It'll also open up avenues for using cannabis that's developed outside of the current federal drug supply system for medical purposes, which I think is also going to be an important factor in really evaluating and understanding the medical benefits of cannabis and its and related preparations. You know, the other thing that we haven't talked about much, and I just want to mention before we run out of time, is that alongside the medical marijuana movement that's going forward, there are a lot of pharmaceutical industry and academic groups that are looking at developing very specific constituents of marijuana, like cannabidiol and other things that might have a lot of the same medical benefit that's believed to come from the marijuana plant, but without the side effects, without the intoxication. And in all honesty, I think that that's really the future of cannabis-based medicines, is really identifying very specific compounds from the marijuana plant that could be administered in a route of administration that does not involve smoking.
Where micro-focusing.
Yeah, so the people are going to get the benefit that they need from the plant material, but without having to use it in kind of a crude manner when you're looking at medical purposes.
Let's go back to our phone lines. Danny is joining us next from Oshkosh. Hi, Danny. Danny, you're on the air. And we have lost him, so we're going to move on instead to Noah in Kewaunee. Hi, Noah.
Hi, just a question on, it's kind of a little off topic, I guess, but it just seems like the whole, it's a very untapped market, and what's the job creation like, you know, with something like this where there's no jobs in it now, and with, you know, alcohol and tobacco being similar drugs, and it's a huge industry with so many jobs, what the possibilities could be with marijuana in the future?
Okay, thanks a lot for the question, Noah. What do you think, Ryan?
Well, I think the sky's the limit with this thing. And if you look at the states where it's medically available legally and now recreationally available, right now, again, because there's no federal regulatory oversight, the marijuana industry in the U.S. is, I think, a pure capitalist market where there's a lot of money changing hands, a lot of job opportunities, and a lot of room for growth. And that's coming, you know, on the cultivation and production side of things. People are getting very creative in terms of creating new products, extracts and oils and things of that nature. And edible products. I mean, there's a whole food infused cannabis market now. And then there's also going to be a whole bunch of development, as I mentioned just a second ago, in terms of alternate, cannabis-based medicines. So that can be a big push for the medical development pharmaceutical industry. And then beyond that, forensic testing and chemical laboratory analysis of this stuff is also another area where you can have a kind of a boom in terms of job market.
All right, Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Ryan Vondre, Associate Professor of Behavioral Pharmacology Research at Johns Hopkins University. When it comes to thinking about where the most beautiful theaters in the world are, there's a good chance your mind takes you to Europe or the east and west coasts of the United States. But according to a recent news piece, maybe we should be looking right here in Wisconsin instead.
CNN recently named the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee as one of the world's most spectacular theaters, only one of very few located in the United States on that list.
Amy Rice joins us now. She's executive director of the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So CNN's list of the world's most spectacular theaters includes beautiful historic venues like places in London and Paris. I think Shakespeare's Globe is on there. What does it mean to you that your theater in Menominee, Wisconsin is right up there in that list?
Well, it's a huge honor, and people keep asking me if I'm surprised, and I always say I'm not surprised. I'm honored, but I'm not surprised. I get to come to work here every single day, and from the moment I walked into this building 3 years ago for the very first time, I've known it's a special, gorgeous place. So it's an incredible honor.
Amy, I'll be honest, I haven't been there. Can you give me a taste? Why is the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts so spectacular?
Well, Chris, you need to visit, first of all. What makes it so spectacular, I think from the outside, you would never know what's on the inside. From the outside, it is big Dunville sandstone bricks. It looks a little bit like a castle. It's somewhat masculine, a little bit foreboding and ominous. But the moment you walk in the door, it has an incredible, feminine, welcoming feeling. The Victorian-era theater is Richardsonian Romanesque architecture. It is a beautiful, intimate space. It's 251 seats. And as a result of the renovation that took place in 2006, we now have a gorgeous gold butterfly curtain. All of the stenciling was redone. The seats were restored. It is an absolutely impeccable, beautiful facility, and it looks much as it did when it opened in 1890.
And it has a lot of history. I've actually seen shows in the Mabel Tainter Theater before. Can you tell us a little bit about, some of the more remarkable things that have happened there over the years?
Well, we've had a number of famous artists over the years. In the past several years here at the Mabel Tainter, we've had some people who have been on national television. Tim Harmston is a local comedian who's been on David Letterman and The Last Comic Standing. He and his wife, Mary Mack, have performed here. Most recently, last fall, we had Home Free Vocal Band had performed on our stage, and they went on to win NBC show. So it was exciting to have them here. We work very hard to have a diverse performing arts season. We've had everything from aerialist circus arts to Continental Ballet's The Nutcracker, rock music, opera, everything here at the Mabel Tainter. We work hard to ensure that there's something for everyone.
Can you give us a little bit of the history behind the origin of the Mabel Tainter?
Well, it's a sad and loving story. The Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts was built in honor of young Mabel Tainter, who passed away in 1886 at the age of 19. The medical records are a bit odd from way back then, but we believe she had appendicitis. And her parents, Andrew and Bertha Tainter, were absolutely heartbroken. And at the urging of their Unitarian pastor, Reverend Dodie Maxson, they chose to build this facility in her honor. She was someone who loved the arts, in particular music and literature. So they began building the facility 125 years ago, and actually April of 1889, and it opened in 1890. When it first opened, it was not only a beautiful Victorian theater, but also the community library. It was also the home of the Unitarian Church, and it was a meeting place for veterans of the Civil War.
So this is a storied building. It goes back a long way. A lot of people. It has a tragic origin story. And I don't know if you talk about it much, but among locals, there's some talk about it being haunted. What do you make of that?
We've had some interesting experiences here at the Mabel Tainter. And we are, in fact, going to be partnering with other theaters in the Chippewa Valley and the St. Croix Valley who also have stories of being haunted to offer some public tours and share those stories. But yes, some of us who have been on staff or volunteered at the Mabel Tainter have had some interesting experiences.
Can you tell us one quick one?
I can tell you a quick one. Okay, so one night I was here quite late. It was a summer evening, and my office is the former pastor's study, which is on the balcony level of the theater. And I was planning on working pretty late, and so I was going to play some music in the theater because the theater has amazing acoustics and a great sound system thanks to the renovation. So I was going to put a CD in the sound system, and I walked out and I heard a noise from the stage. I heard, ha ha, like a child laughing. And at first I thought, who's here? Who brought a child in here? And it took me a moment, and I realized it is late at night. There is no way there's anyone else in here. I had said goodbye to my staff. I knew that they had locked the facility, and I was the only one here. It was a really interesting experience. It wasn't scary. It wasn't scary at all.
Right.
None of the experiences we've had have been scary. They've always been sort of light and fun and, oh, how interesting. They're here.
Interesting.
Well, what's been the reaction from the community to this CNN piece? Again, you're Menominee's on a list with London and Paris and big cities around the world.
I think the community is really proud. I think most people who participate here on a regular basis are like me. They're honored but not surprised. The other thing that's been exciting is there are a lot of people in this community who have never, they've lived here their entire lives and maybe they've never set foot in the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts. And this has provided a little bit of a nudge in that direction for them to come and see what all the fuss is about. So in the last couple months since the news hit in April, we have had a number of patrons who have attended our shows and the shows of some of our partner organizations. The Menominee Theater Guild also performs their main stage season here, 4 shows annually, plus a youth performance in the summer. And I know that people from throughout the region, Madison, the Twin Cities, have made it a special trip to come and see what is the fuss. And everyone that has set foot in here has just said it is a very special, gorgeous place, and it literally takes your breath away when you walk into that theater. It just does.
What is your favorite show that you've seen there that really plays to the beauty of the place and the acoustics?
It's hard to say because it's such a sweet, intimate theater, and I mean, everything that we've had here the Nutcracker is stunning on stage to see in such a beautiful ballet in this beautiful Victorian space. We've had everything from that to, this crazy rock 1980s hair band concert called Power Ballads sold out last fall, and people want to, have that again. Really, everything that we've had here, everything seems to work in this space, honestly. And the performers who come here, everyone who sets foot on that stage says there's nothing else like performing at the Mabel. They love coming back here.
Well, Amy, congratulations on making that list.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for the interview.
We've been talking to Amy Reese, Executive Director of the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts.